and welcome to Coffee Press with your favorite coffee brothers. Brother Andrew, how are you?
I am absolutely stupendous. Brother Brendan, I appreciate you asking. How are you?
I am stellar. And in my light race, you'll understand why I'm stellar. But I am quite stellar. Thank you for asking.
That's good to hear. I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say about the double meaning for that one. So, as always, some housekeeping. Get in touch with the Brothers Coffee. Shoot us an email at thecoffeepress@gmail.com.
Leave us a voice message through Anchor. The link will be in the show notes. Or you can tweet us at thecoffeepress on Twitter.
Today's brew, as always, is going to consist of our light roast segment where we talk about what we're reading, watching, playing, consuming in any way over the last week.
Once you finish that, we'll serve you up our dark roast, which is an extensive examination of the more profound concepts found in our favorite content.
And to cap it all off, we have espresso roast where the Brothers Coffee answer your questions lightning round style.
Finally, before we jump in, warnings. Our show will contain both adult content and spoilers. So, Brother Andrew, what has your mind been chewing on this last week?
So, I know it's been a little bit since we've been able to record. Brother Brendan, myself, our family, my girlfriend, we were on vacation for 10 days out west, Lake Tahoe, Mammoth Lakes. We had a great time.
Yosemite.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. We're very, very blessed to be able to go on that trip. So that was nice. But so it's been a while, but since we've been back, I have been, and this has been you can call it a guilty pleasure if you want. I don't know if it's technically considered a guilty pleasure, but I love cooking shows, mainly competitions. So, you know, we're talking shows like Chopped, Guys Grocery Games, you know, Next Food Network Star, all that kind of stuff. Iron Chef, Hell's Kitchen. I love that crap. So in the last week, I've been watching a lot of Guys Grocery Games.
Brother Andrew, we have a lot in common, and I just have to share, this is not one of those things.
Yes, no, I know that for sure. I know.
What do you think about these types of shows? Do you find so, I don't know, is it just being able to look at images of food?
A lot of
food being prepared in a really masterful way.
It could be, but I'll also say this. So since we've gotten back from our vacation, my girlfriend and I, we have been strict keto dieting, which has been going well so far. It's not awesome by any means, but it's also not terrible just because we've done a pretty good job. It's only been like, I don't know, 10 days since we've been back. So, you know, we've been doing pretty well. I'm sure people who've been doing it for a lot longer than that will tell you, you know, you're pretty fucked, but it's been going well. So I've always liked cooking. I've always enjoyed cooking. I've done nothing but cook at home since we got back from our trip. So I've been doing a lot of cooking at home. I guess I just like to see the creativity, and it really is fascinating to me how these chefs can do these, can create these dishes with the proverbial hand tied behind their back. So in these competitions, like, it's not just a straight up like, hey, cook something good. It's like, you know, in Chopped, they'll give you a basket full of random ingredients and then you have to make something out of it, right? Yep. So you have to use your creativity. And then Guys Grocery Games, they'll put a spin on it. They'll say, you know, make me your best bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich, but you can only use aisles 4, 5, and 6, right? And like, so they have to be creative and figure out different ways to cook these things. And also it just looking at carbs is going to have to satisfy my craving for carbs for the next little bit. So just looking at them helps so far.
I think I don't love cooking, but you know what I do love is coming up with the, so there's this one show that that they sabotage each other and they choose.
That's another one we've been watching is Cutthroat Kitchen with Alton Brown.
And coming up with some of the stuff that they do to each other
it's hysterical.
Incredible, right?
It's hilarious. You have
to use this pair of children's scissors.
Yeah.
To cut up everything involved in this recipe is just amazing and hilarious. And
oh, it's great. No, it's awesome. And then I think the best part of that is when the judge, because some people will some people will be sabotaged beyond all repair.
Yeah.
So when the judge doesn't know that they had to use a baseball bat as their prep station, so then they'll come up to this shitty looking pile of goop and the judge will be like, wow, what terrors did you just have to go through to produce this, you know? That's what I've been consuming over the last week. My last 10 days, like I've said, have been revolved a lot around food and about what food I can and can't eat. So watching those shows, one, like I said, at least looking at delicious, satisfying carbohydrate-laden food will satisfy my craving or will curb it at least just a little bit. But other than that, I've always liked cooking. I think it's cool just to see, the creativity these people can come up with. With the parameters that are set around their competition.
I think it's unfair to judge these shows because I think that when I think about cooking shows, I just imagine barefoot Contessa or
whatever. All right, first of all, fuck that show.
Oh my God.
Hate that show.
Okay, we should probably call Alex. Sorry, Mother Coffee, because I think she loves that show. And that's why it's the only show that I know.
Yeah. So it's funny because when I was younger and I would watch Food Network with our mother, there'd be Barefoot Contessa on. And then there'd be 30-minute meals with Rachel Ray. And I don't really like that kind of cooking shows. Because those are
Right. That's what I think of in my mind when I think cooking shows. So it's these are more these are more reality competition shows.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do with cooking. Because you also the outdoors, what we talked about last time, the outdoor, the survive in the wild.
Yep. Yeah, right? Alone.
It's kind of the same. It's the same thing where it's these people are challenged in ways that are really challenging. And you have to be industrious and creative,
resourceful, absolutely.
Think outside the box, right? In order to be able to and it's fascinating to see how different people, particularly when they're skilled, when they're highly skilled, and I think in both examples, they are right. I guess theoretically, I don't think they just take some accountant from Delaware and put them in the woods, right?
No. These people are accomplished survival experts, right? Right. They all might have their niche, mm-hmm. in terms of this person is really good at identifying indigenous plants and what's edible and what's not. And then other people are this person's a world champion archer or something like that. But they mm-hmm. all they have to apply for that. You can't just send Dale, your accountant, out there and hope that he makes it.
They actually kidnap people.
But I would watch that. I would watch the shit out of that too. I'd watch average Joes go out there and fucking try to survive.
Well, Steven's been crying for the last 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I think the winner of that competition would win at day three.
Yeah.
Food Network did what they had to do to make cooking shows interesting, right? Because if they just kept pumping out Barefoot Contessa 30-minute meals type shit, I think they'd lose a lot of, I mean, like, I sure as hell wouldn't watch that. Yeah. But I would watch these other, you know, kind of ridiculous reality competition type shows that, you know, where, you know, somebody's got a, you know, their prep station is like a freaking, you know, they have to be on rollerblades the whole time, you know?
Oh my God, is that really, wow, what a fabulous transition. I'm just kidding, but like that we'll talk about rollerblades in my late race too.
Sure. And as always, what has your mind been chewing on this last week, Brendan?
I've fallen into similar to, it sounds like a very specific a rut, but mine is, of course, far nerdier, and it's Star Trek Voyager. I turned it on just sort of randomly to like be background. Like there's a couple of shows that fall into that, and it's been a really long time since I've seen Voyager. So I kind of just popped it on like while I was doing like busy work for work. And all of a sudden we're like in season 3 on episode 21 and you're crying and like we're like really invested and it happened all at once.
Yeah.
I have been rollerblading and hiking a lot. I did my first 14er, which is this like ridiculous thing that exists, I think, only in Colorado because there are mountains that are over 14,000 feet from sea level.
That's a lot of feet.
Yes. And it's so interesting because I learned so much in such a short amount of time about like, and it's gorgeous. It is absolutely breathtaking in Colorado. It is, I finally in one swift Saturday kind of had like I feel like the penultimate Colorado experience. Stars and mountains, and of course like the first thing that I'm thinking is like Lord of the Rings, and like this is the breathtaking like majesty,
yeah,
that, you know, that writers are like are inspired by, and like, and people, everybody's inspired, like it's crazy. It was so beautiful.
So when you say a 14er, is that like just strictly on the elevation that you accomplished?
That's right. And that's what I think. And that's why, like, I will admit I went with some people and I asked, it was like 6 hours or so into this hike that I asked, like, so there's some like 14er has no measurement on the distance.
Yeah. That, I mean,
the measurement to do with the elevation.
Yeah. That's what I assumed as much, is that it had to do with the elevation, not any kind of distance.
Right. So there are some, I guess that it's a dumb thing to say, but like some 14ers are a lot easier than other 14ers because you're able to start at a higher, because if you start it at 1350, a 14er is like whatever. It's a hike, right? What we did was an 8 hour, really 5.5 hours there, like 3 hours back. Like, and again, I say this like it was brutal, and it, like, there were parts where they were brutal, but like getting to the top was so incredibly satisfying. Bart came with me. Bart did such a good job.
Did Bart do okay?
Oh my God, he did such a good job. The fact that Bart could like move the next day when like I couldn't, and he was like, are we gonna go play? I was like, oh buddy, like I think I need to like do this like once a week, I guess, because he just sprang right back.
Yeah, that's one of those things where you are a little disappointed when your dog is still functioning the next day. You're like, I was really banking on you to be kind of down and out for at least a day. Yeah.
So, you know, like the concept of like awe, being like in awe of something, like to what degree is that impacted if you have a name for it and you can measure it?
People misuse, but people overuse the word awesome.
Yes.
So that, you know, when you do, you know, when you do something like you said, like a 14er, and you have these, you know, majestic vistas, that is truly awesome. It inspires awe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like awe, to your question, is you're like speechless. Like there is no,
you're staggered.
Exactly. Like you can't quantify that. You can't like put a label on it.
What about like knowing the name of something, for example, like, okay, if like what we did was Huron and like that it is 14,000 feet, like, right. To say like, to be able to measure and name it, does that take away from the awe in any way?
And when we were in Yosemite and we kind of like rounded a bend, and then like, you know, Dad was like, that's El Capitan. And then I went and looked at it and I was like, oh shit. Like that's, I've only seen that on National Geographic, and now I'm seeing it with my own eyes. I don't think it takes away from the awe. I think sometimes it can add to it, because when he said those words to me, like El Capitan is, yeah, is legendary, you know, it's kind of like it has like a legendary status, you know, just like Old Faithful and Yellowstone, or even it's still in Yosemite, Half Dome, like these things, the Grand Canyon, like when you see the Grand Canyon, you're like, wow, like, so this is what I've seen or read about or heard about or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it can add to it for sure.
Right. And I think the same thing goes with numbers too, where it's like, it's, you know, there's just like, there's a, wow, this is a quantity of something that, you know, it's like, this is what that looks like. Right. So it's like the ocean has so many gallons of water, and it's like, say, like you can quantify it, but that doesn't take away from the awe that,
yep,
or that doesn't even really, like, it does. I don't feel like with the gallons thing, I mean, like it might, it's like just, it's, I'm sure there's trillions of, I don't even know what the number is, because it doesn't matter. It's more than I can contemplate.
Yep. Yeah.
Brother Andrew, what do we have on the docket for this week's Dark Roast?
So this week we are going to talk about money and the role that money and economy plays in some of our favorite stories, some of our favorite movies, maybe even video games, not sure, but that's just what we're going to be talking about this week. We wanted to kind of do a little bit of investigating on whether or not money, currency, economy, you know, whether it adds to a story, if it takes away from a story, if we need a little more exposition about said things in the, you know, in the course of a story. So far, we have a number of examples that we've pulled to discuss today.
Let's talk about kind of like a little bit of what sparked tonight's Dark Roast was, as we talked about, Jim Dale you know, the almighty put to sleeper. Listening to some Harry Potter, there's a scene where in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Ron recognizes that the gold that he paid Harry back with in the beginning of the book for the Omnioculars actually ends up disappearing. And Ron realizes this in the middle of the book. And it's very much a, it's kind of like, you know, where the record, the needle slips from the record.
Yep.
Right. Like there's all this shit going on, dude. Like I think that it's the same scene where we recognize that like Lord Voldemort is like, you know, doing some crazy shit. And,
yep,
and like Harry is like, well, you know, this is, you know what this means? It's that Voldemort knew that Bertha Jorkins, whatever, whatever. And all of a sudden Ron just like stops. He's like, everybody stop. Stop what you're doing. Turns to Harry and says like, does that mean that what I paid you back with at the Quidditch World Cup was not real?
And yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I guess you're right. And then Ron's like, why didn't you say something? Like, why did you not say something to me? And Harry's
because
like,
I'm fucking rich.
I know. It can be in the car. Because I'm filthy loaded.
Yeah, because I'm fucking rich, dude.
I am absolutely good to go.
Yeah.
And like Ron's like, and like it's a very, very quick beat, right? It's very, very quick, but it's such, I don't know, it just really stuck out to me, I think, as maybe just rereading it, at, you know, again, for the 9,000,000 to 100,000th time.
And Ron gives the great line that says it must be nice to have a pocket full of gold disappear and not even notice.
Right.
And like you said, it is kind of happening in the middle of all this really heavy shit. And then Ron is hung up on like the fact that he gave him 20 galleons and they're gone now. And Harry didn't even notice.
Yeah.
Show how much money and financial security, status, whatever, has affected Ron's life.
Right. And I think it also, so it's, I've been thinking about it, and it does, it's a fascinating, again, but super short beat, where it also answers potentially, or maybe even it again, who knows the design, right, is to say, who knows what her intention is by putting this in, but it also sort of answers a question that maybe we, the reader, have, without realizing or not, had for the duration, is to say, like, well, if I have, like, magic, and I can just, like, whip up some food or money.
Or fix something.
Oh, my goodness. Right. Yeah. Like, all the stuff that costs money, then what does, how exactly does, why is, you know, well, and also it's like, again, like if you could just conjure up money potentially, right? Like, I guess it's like, it almost like it half answers a question, but it answers it in a way that I feel like is so off that then it makes you come back and have to ask it again. Does it make sense? Where it's like, well, what exactly if I could conjure money? And then they're like, oh, well, you can't do that. Silly. The money disappears. And
exactly.
Then we as the reader, we're like, okay, then so what?
And this question may or may not have come up to us just because of the staggering number of times that we have gone through these books. But, and I'm not sure it's come up for other people, but to true Harry Potter fans, I'm sure that the question has come up. And it all kind of starts with the description of the Burrow, which is the Weasley's household. And in the second book, Chamber of Secrets, we get a description from J.K. Rowling about the house that Ron's family lives in. And in the first book, you kind of get some little tidbits here and there about the family's overall financial status, you know, whether it's Malfoy being a fucking prick and, you know, citing the financial hardships of the Weasleys. But Rowling says it looked as though it had once been a large stone pig pen, but extra rooms had been added here until it was several stories high and so crooked it looked as though it were held up by magic, which Harry reminded himself it probably was. So, like, that sentence right there, which Harry reminded himself it probably was, is kind of what's feeding our question about how can you be poor if you can do magic? Because why does it have to be crooked? Why don't you straighten that shit out? Right? Like, can't you just, like, if you can truly do the things that Rowling says you can do in the book with said magic, it's very confusing,
right,
to how you could truly be, like, piss poor like the Weasleys are. And yeah. I think
because what it suggests is essentially that, like, okay, because the other thing is, like, there's a certain amount of, like, oh, of course, like, this has been speculated by, as to Andrew's point, like, there's been speculated to, like, more than just us, right? So there's a lot of discourse on the internet about, like, what does this mean? And I think that, like, this is an oversimplified way of saying this, but it's to say that, like, oh, well, magical money is protected magically, so you can't magically reproduce it. Okay, yeah. Well, like, so does that mean that, like, I can buy, like, does that, why does Mr. Weasley then not have any, like, muggle, like, why does he not have a Ferrari?
Yeah.
Like, why does that, like, I don't, I, like, it, it's, again, like, it, like, this is why it's, like, such a, it's a deft sort of device to say, like, oh, well, you can't, like, but it's also, like, it somehow, at the exact same time, like, then puts in a sharp relief, like, how much sense it doesn't make.
Yeah. And, like, for example, I think it's at the beginning of the sixth book when Harry and Dumbledore visit Slughorn to try to recruit him for a teacher at Hogwarts. And Slughorn trashes the muggle home that they're in to make it seem like there was a struggle and he got kidnapped or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a wave of his fucking wand, Dumbledore fixes everything in the house. Everything gets fixed back to beautiful, normal, whatever. Yep. So if you can do something like that, then you should be able to, I don't know, like clean your fucking house up or straighten it out or not make it so crooked or tall or whatever. You can like have a bunch of materials sitting on the ground and then wave your wand and they build themselves into a beautiful room or a beautiful house or whatever. It's just, and then I'll let you touch on this next because I know that we talked about this earlier, but then we talk about food and the system of food at Hogwarts.
We're probably looking at this a little too closely, but let's...
Oh, way too closely. way too closely.
Let's stick with it. Again, it's this very interesting, like, plot point where, like, everything stops and like, Hermione all of a sudden has this deep-seated recognition that, like, oh my god, the food that we eat here in the Great Hall is prepared downstairs. And like and there are four tables that look exactly like the tables that are up in the Great Hall. And she just has this moment where she's like, I can't eat this anymore. Right. And so I think that like what we're kind of brought to realize is to say, like, so does that mean that the house elves downstairs, you know, are buying things from Costco?
Yeah.
Is that really like I guess otherwise, because Miss Weasley absolutely like shot some chicken broth out of her wand.
Yeah. And so are the house elves cooking? Are they conjuring? What are they doing in the kitchens? Because then like when in later in the books when they visit the kitchens, there's they cite that Fred and George will like steal some food from the kitchens for like a party in the common room or whatever. Yeah. So like there's a lot of food that's just kind of like on deck down there, and it's
do they have like special implements that are magical? You know, again, like it's none of this. We're getting really super deep into the logistics of it, but it's still like bubbled back up to Topples to say is like, if food does not, or sorry, if money does not pay for food, okay, if money does not pay for arguably housing, which is where we get that scene in the Chamber of Secrets where he basically says like it is actually magic that is keeping together this house. Food and housing, right, are the two kind of like, I don't know, primary things that like the whole world needs. And it's like to say, how can that look any different for other wizards? Like, how is that? That's not this. So what does money pay for?
Yeah, exactly. So like, when you say what does money pay for, right, the things that we see in the books that are being paid for is like mostly like school supplies, because you know, the majority of the money spending, you know, we're talking Diagon Alley, and then and then kind of a subset of that, then you have money spending at Hogsmeade, which is the town next to Hogwarts, and then maybe if you even want to include it, like buying some food on the Hogwarts Express on the way to school.
Right.
But I'll kind of do my last point about Harry Potter in terms of economy is that it does. And we talked about this. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of career paths that you can take after leaving Hogwarts, right? Like the only quote unquote jobs they speak of is predominantly Ministry of Magic. Then just my own thoughts is like, other than the Ministry of Magic, there's like two options. There's like owning a shop in like Diagon Alley or Hogsmeade, or working as a teacher at Hogwarts. It doesn't seem like there's any other avenue for you to go. And like they definitely don't talk about it in the books.
No. Yeah. And I think this is also very much like this is like framed from a juvenile perspective. Like I guess
like these are kids' books, right? And that's okay.
And
right?
we're just over here like, this doesn't add up. Like, what the fuck was she thinking?
This doesn't add up. But it's totally fair to ask, like, especially, like, I don't know, like, in some of the ways that, like, we think that money, like, again, like, it's when we think about plot drivers, right? Like, I think the obvious contrast that is made, like, over and over and over again is that the Malfoys are quite wealthy and the Weasleys are quite poor. Right. And Malfoy, yep, like, uses that. And I think this is, like, it's really it. And dude, just like, and again, I think it's a lot of hyperbole, let's call it, just to really, because it's a kid's book. So we want to paint big pictures, but we paint some big pictures about how Malfoy, like, ridicules the Weasleys, like, very openly in front of, like, oh, elected officials, I guess. Right?
Yeah, so, like, true. Like, oh, so true.
You are so poor. Yeah. Like, he says in front of the Minister of Magic in the top box.
Yeah.
The fucking Quidditch World Cup. He's like, how could you have afforded these tickets? Surely your house couldn't have made it.
Like, yeah. Your house
would not have actually covered this.
Yeah. And then, like, the Minister of Magic's just like, right up.
Sure. Yep. Sounds good to me.
Sure. No.
Good, yeah. Good man.
Good man.
Just, like, pats him on the back and says, like, whatever you say, Lucius, and it's just like,
that's my boy.
Like, where is he? Like, what are you talking about? Like, and so it's like, how, so I guess the reason we're bringing this all up is to say that, like, that this has to do with how money sort of plays a plot driving role in this narrative, right? To say, like, this, a lot of the plot is driven by the tension between the sort of the wealthy class of let's say pure blood wizards, and so it's like they're both of them are pure blood, right? The Weasleys and the Malfoys are both pure blood, and all of this has to do, this is essentially extra muggle, right? To say there's no muggles involved, and yet there's still this tension between sort of the 1% and the rest of us, right? And I think that it's fine, but then of course, like, you dig a little deeper and you say, like, well, what actually drives, like, yeah, the economy here, right? What,
yeah,
you know, so,
and it kind of further lengthens the divide between classes, right? Like you mentioned, like, purebloods versus, you know, half bloods, muggleborns, right? So there's that caste system, if you will, and then on top of that, even though both the Malfoys and the Weasleys are both pure blood wizards, they still are at each other's throats because of their financial mm-hmm. tier, you know, their financial status.
That's right.
In the world. And so it's just, it like you said, it is a kid's book, and they do paint big pictures. So they definitely, you know, it is exaggerated to an extent, just so that the message can be conveyed to, you know, younger readers, right? But it definitely, you know, it opens up those kind of questions, especially when you dig a little deeper.
I think we'll probably have other, I mean, because we love this kind of stuff, we'll probably have other podcasts on things like class and, you know, all oligarchy and sort of, and even kind of like, yeah, like socio-political, socio-democrat, whatever,
yep,
like that kind of thing, like within this stuff. But I think that obviously money plays a central role, and that, like, it definitely is something that that drives a lot of conflict, and they say, like, as a plot device, that's okay, right? But then, like let's maybe unpack that. So I think one story, if you will, or one set of stories that kind of it actually eliminates money as a conflict, or at least in certain regards. So Star Trek talks a lot about how money has, at the time of Star Trek, in like the 24th century, has actually eliminated money as a part of natural societal progression.
Yeah.
So Earth has eliminated, like, is to say, like, and they kind of, like, they dismiss it to say, like, oh, well, we were able to get, like, to do away with that.
And then, and honestly, do a little of judgment and a little like looking down on societies or on cultures that are still like, are still money driven, right? They talk specifically in Deep Space Nine. There's an episode where they say that societies that use money were described as quote unquote, practicing currency based economies, right? As if it's like, they were practicing unsafe sex.
Okay, so it's like looked down upon, if you will, or like it's looked as barbaric. As an archaic, barbaric,
yeah,
system.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yep. And so it's like it's so the people that are kind of our the audience adjacent, right? The like is that are kind of like, oh, okay, so money's actually not a driving factor in some of these episodes. And I think it talks to the greater premise of Star Trek, where Star Trek is really kind of this ethical laboratory. Where yeah. you just say like, well, what if you remove that and add some of this and turn this knob and whatever? And then all of a sudden, like, what would happen then? Does that make sense? Or it's like,
we have
the prime directive that says like, don't mess with like societies we've just met. And then we have the, this set of people who say this thing, and we have that other set of people, and there's this technology and these factors, and I have to make a decision, right? I think that because money is such a driving factor, even in maybe the continuity space, is to say like, but how expensive is all of this? And they're like, oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I feel like it's that sounds, and I'll be honest, I'm not very familiar with Star Trek. I'm definitely not as familiar with Star Trek as Brother Brendan is, but it seems like deliberate in that sense, so that it doesn't bring up those questions. It doesn't bring up the questions of why we just literally did a colonoscopy on Harry Potter, right? You know, it's just I feel like it was deliberate so that people weren't like, well, wait a second, that doesn't add up, you know, like we did.
I know. But it's, yes. Yeah. It is. It's just a big hand wave. It's a big hand wave to say like, that's not a factor here. Like it doesn't have to add up. But I think but again, that comes back to the bigger premise that we talked about in our first episode around like world building, and to say that it does the economy, does I think there's an if then statement. If this is brought up as a factor in one sense, like there has to be a certain amount of like continuity, I guess, that does like tie it together.
Sure. Yeah. Like if you introduce this, you have to complete the circle. You have to fill in the blank. You have to keep continuity, like you said, with, you know, it like, I know that you just paid homage to the first episode. I'm going to talk about the one about time travel. It's like you said about J.K. Rowling and time travel, is like introducing X into your story, whether it be time travel or money or economics or anything like that. You better be ready for that roller coaster ride. You better be ready to produce and, complete that sentence, complete that thought or idea or whatever. And so I feel like it sounds like Star Trek just didn't want anything to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also like, it's part of the type of storytelling you're doing. There's some stories that it does have to add up, and there's other stories that it doesn't. Right. And I think that the reason, just to jump back real fast to Harry Potter, the reason why I think that we, at least for me, I think that the story matures, like Harry matures, right? The world, or at least like, again, we go from like school boy story to like adult story, right? Where like,
oh,
people die and like, people, and it gets real.
Yep.
And so like, and I think that that's where it's like, there's this dissonance from where it's like there are parts of the story that are okay, but they've been left alone since we saw them in basically like middle school.
Yep.
Like we saw middle school Harry dealing with like, oh, like Weasleys are poor, like the Malfoys are rich, and this is kind of broadly speaking, here's what happens, or even here are the different job options I have as a wizard, right? We didn't really return to that in Harry Potter.
Which, yeah, because it becomes a non-factor. All those things just become immaterial as the story progresses and gets more mature and real.
Right. The stakes get higher, right?
Oh, yeah.
Stakes get higher and higher. And I think that the other thing is too, is that like, I think that every single character, and I'm kind of riffing here because I can't remember exactly. I think every single character we know ultimately works for the ministry at some point. To the point you made, right? I think that Hermione is maybe Minister of Magic, Harry is an Auror, and I don't know exactly what Ron does. He's a stay-at-home dad.
No, he's just still poor as shit. Even though his wife Hermione is the Minister of Magic.
He specifically is still,
still poor.
Like, that's just my thing.
Yeah.
So Star Trek does wander away from that to say that, like, and there's some, the other thing real quick on the Star Trek thing is that there are species that are known for their greed, and some of the same things come up in Star Trek to say, like, well, in a, like, it's just inconsistencies, like in a world where you can replicate things, and that, you know, like what, how does currency will be affected by all of these things. But again, I think that it if played the right way, it will fit. And then you can turn it down when you don't need it as much from, like, an authorial perspective.
Exactly. And I think that's what J.K. Rowling does in Harry Potter is, like, there are certain points in that story where, like, she needs to turn that knob up on currency, economics, socioeconomic status, things like that. And then when she doesn't need it, it's gone. Like, it's in it, and it doesn't pertain to this part of the story. And just like you said, for Star Trek, there are times where, like you said, I'm sure there's episodes that are on certain species that are exceptionally greedy, right? And in that episode, we'll turn that knob up because we need it right now. But in the overall, you know, story, it's not going to be, that knob's not going to stay at 10, right? That's going to be turned down based on its need. And I think that's a good segue from a story that doesn't seem to, you know, use a lot of money, currency, economics in their storytelling, to a story that does use a lot of money, economics, and whatnot in its story, and that is Game of Thrones. And I am proud to take this example, as I have recently completed the series, and I can now speak on this. I can now talk about this. So what I wrote down about money in Game of Thrones is something interesting that I thought about, because in Game of Thrones, they introduce, I don't think it's even the first season. I believe it's in the third season is kind of when this is dropped on you. In the first season, there's a little bit of talk about the Iron Throne being in debt. And so it kind of goes off of, who is the Iron Throne in debt to? And the entities that we get is one being the Iron Bank and two being the Lannister family. And so it's interesting because if you take the quote unquote Iron Throne, the king, the country, if you will, is in debt millions of gold dragons, I believe is the currency, is if the Iron Throne is in debt to the Iron Bank, does that not make the Iron Bank more powerful than the throne? Because, I mean, listen, if you're in debt, you know, up to your eyeballs to a certain entity, they kind of have you by the balls, by the proverbial balls, right?
Yeah. So I'm going to answer with the limited. This is going to be a fun thing for people to just, like, tear apart that know more about what I'm about to say than I do. But I'm going to just quickly take a stab at it.
Sure.
So, like, I guess when I think about a bank and the power that they wield when it comes to debt, right, is that, like, I can repossess and sell your assets.
Correct.
Okay.
ipso facto.
Now this is further complicated, right, by the presence of the military, right? Where and again, this is if you think back to like Roman history, I have some familiarity, right? Where it's like the Roman again, this is where all this government and again, this is why it's interesting that these stories are painting. Again, I love this analogy we're using, is we're like, we're telling stories, so we're painting big pictures, right? Any of this in the real world is far too complicated to be able to actually like get like to try and reconcile, because you know what, it's not reconcilable in the real world.
Yep.
Money is complicated, right?
Yep. And
we'll get a little bit into this as we unpack this, but it's to say that in Game of Thrones, you're right. It doesn't necessarily say like, I don't know what that means. I don't know exactly what being in debt to the Iron Bank means, and what they, if you default on your payments, what recourse do they have? Is that answered? Again, you're an expert because you've seen it more recently. But do they have like a huge army to come?
So here's in my memory, I don't remember what their specific recourse is for not paying your debts, but I do remember there being a couple of times where it's referenced that soldiers will fight for whoever's got the gold. And so,
yep.
And in Game of Thrones, they, you know, they buy armies, right? Armies are bought. It's a commodity, right? Armies are bought. And, you know, that's seen with Daenerys and the Unsullied. And then Cersei buys the gold legion, gold something. My apologies for not having that on hand, but she purchases an army. And so I don't know what I don't think it's touched on, because it would be a little dicey for the story, right? Because I just don't know what the Iron Bank could do if they defaulted on their loan, right? I just don't know what they would do.
But I think it gets back to, oh, sorry. And I know that we keep circling this, but the question of course becomes like, does it fundamentally matter? And to say that like in the story of Game of Thrones, and I think this is gets back to kind of our theme here, is to say that like it, like Brother Andrew, is money wielded like effectively? Is it a plot driver in a way that's like, okay, I'm compelled by this and I'm still in the story, or does it throw you out of the story in any way?
So it doesn't, and it's just like the example of turning up the dial, right? So there are certain points in the show where they need to turn that dial up. And I remember specifically Stannis Baratheon goes to the Iron Bank because, you know, I think Ser Davos has an apostrophe, aka an epiphany, I've had an apostrophe. He has an epiphany that, like, oh, well, we can just like get a fucking loan or something from the Iron Bank and purchase these ships, purchase these men that we need for, you know, this upcoming battle. And they go to the Iron Bank, right? They're there. And so in those couple episodes, when it really matters, that dial is cranked up to 10, because like that's important to the narrative of those episodes, right? But then after that's done, it's just kind of done, and we kind of don't really hear about it anymore, and it's situational. The reason that we're talking about it is just because we want to dig into whether or not money, currency, economy is used effectively in these stories. And if sometimes it impedes the story from being told, it kind of, like you said, it throws you out of the story. But I think in the case of Game of Thrones, I think they do a good job because it's used as a conflict creator, and you can see the conflicts that go on and the economics that go on, especially if you pay attention to the small council meetings in King's Landing, right? When the Master of Coin is talking about, you know, what they're going to do for this, what they're going to do for that, how they're going to pay for this wedding, blah, blah, blah. So like when it's needed, I think it's effectively leveraged in Game of Thrones to kind of paint the overall picture of like the general status of things in the realm.
Yeah. I think the other thing that sticks out that, and maybe Brother Andrew, you can help me remember, cause it's been a while since I've seen it, but like, I don't really recall any particular character or any particular plot line particularly driven by the socioeconomic space that they're in. Like, I think we know, for example, that the Starks, I think, right, go from like relatively comfortable to like all sorts of fucked up, like in like Arya's situation where like she's a beggar in the streets, like on the other continent, right? And
yes,
like, stuff, right? Like that stuff makes sense. But particularly when I think about like there's no class conflict that I can really think of as being a driver, which is again a little bit of, I think it goes to the storytelling, it sort of like Star Trek does with money. I think that Game of Thrones to a certain extent does with class. I'm trying to think of a plot that's driven in Game of Thrones by kind of like, well, I'm rich and you're poor, and let's play on that.
So the only instances, I think you're correct in saying that the conflicts that are driven between families or houses or whatever are more about territory. Obviously people fighting for the Iron Throne, but it's not like this house is like piss poor like the Weasleys,
right?
Or this, but I mean, but obviously there's the recurring theme that the Lannisters are just filthy rich, right? And there are many occasions where you know, Tyrion is like, you know, I can pay you, you know, Lannister never like always repays his debts. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like there's those kind of instances, but I think in overall conflict, it doesn't have to do with socioeconomic standing and how rich you are. But then there are times where the Lannisters can buy a fucking army, which they do, right? So there's that, that's where it kind of comes into play. But yeah, a lot of the, it doesn't go into like, oh, the Starks are poor, the Lannisters are rich, you know, these people are also, but you know, it doesn't drive through that lens.
We don't have this like, you're rich and this has this impact on the narrative, and you're, and I'm, I don't have, like, I think that there's some jibes that characters get at like to each other if they're from different classes, but it doesn't really drive a lot of plot.
Yeah, agreed. Like there are some tidbits here and there about class and money and how wealthy somebody is, but it's definitely not a huge plot driver at all.
Okay, so some stories that we talked a little bit about where there is a fairly substantial, like this is almost become part of the actual, like it's a character of itself, where it's like it's a huge, almost again, we paint big pictures to tell these stories, right? So one of them that stood out to me that I love this as a narrative because I also just love the book, and I have this, I remember exactly, I don't know if I still have it or we still have it, but I remember a copy of this book that I own where the cover is pink and it's kind of like just, it's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like it, when you read the book, it just talks about how, like it, how fucking poor, like substantially cripplingly like just holy shit, what the fuck poor Charlie and his family is, right? All four of his grandparents are sleeping in
one bed, one, okay, twin size bed.
I, you know, and like we learn that like Charlie is so poor and he loves chocolate so much that he has to eat a chocolate bar one tiny little bit to make it last a year till his next birthday, right? And I think that, again, this is, it's just, it's so overdone, right? And it's, and it, which is obviously intentional, right? It's so overdone. And I really enjoy it. It's so, and then again, like, I think we then ask ourselves a question in some, and again, this is not obviously the primary thing that happens at the end, but you just think to yourself is to say, okay, Charlie, you are now the, I guess, let's just put this together, the sole inheritor of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, which means you're probably going to like do just fine. And arguably, like, grandma and grandpa can all maybe have their own beds, maybe even go, oh God, their own rooms, because you now own a gigantic super
corporation.
Crazy,
magical
fucking, like, you know, whatever this, you know, so like there, so it's like, there's this transition almost that's part of his character arc that is from, and again, it's not primary. It's not a primary driver of the story or of the narrative, but I think it's used so subtly to be like, because you cared so much about chocolate, and that is like your passion, the money came because you followed that path. I don't know, like something about you following your passion.
For sure. It's kind of like a background conflict resolution type thing, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. the conflict at the beginning is that they're piss poor.
Right.
And then through his good deeds and his love and his passion and determination, whatever, he becomes unpoor, right? Like, that's how, that's the resolution at the end. So
be like, are you poor? All you got to do is inherit a chocolate factory.
Yeah, have I got a deal for you?
I've got just the thing.
Right? Yeah. So, and we only have a couple of examples left. I do want to touch on one in, of course, Star Wars, is, you know, about, there's a couple of instances where currency is brought into play. And what comes to mind is in the first episode, when they touch down on Tatooine to get parts for their ship, Qui-Gon Jinn tries to purchase those parts using Republic credits. And Watto is like, we don't take those here. And it just that it just kind of, in my opinion, it's a great, that quick little beat is good, is very good in describing the state of the galaxy and where they are in the galaxy, right? Like, they are in no man's land. You know, they're in the wild, wild west, if you will, right? They're not, they don't take Republic credits. You know, Republic government issued currency ain't worth a dime out here. Like, this is, but I'll tell you what is, like, a pod racer, gambling on a pod racer, all this other, you know, barbaric-esque type stuff is. And so it just, it's, and I'm glad that Star Wars doesn't dive too deep into currency and economy, because it doesn't really need it. But occasionally they will kind of turn it up to give narrative exposition about, because I mean, that, like I said, that in itself tells you all you need to know about where they are, what the stakes are, all that kind of stuff. So when they need to, they turn the knob up, and it works out very well. The last one I wanted to touch on really quickly, which, and it's very simple, is Aladdin. And Aladdin is just a good, like Brendan and I talked about it earlier, and about how it's almost like a social experiment. And when, you know, humanity is the real great equalizer, because when Jasmine uses her disguise to escape the palace and go out to the commoners, they jive, right? Like, they got to have some good chemistry, right? And then conversely, when Aladdin puts on his disguise as Prince Ali, this rich bastard, goes into the palace, they also jive, right? So it's kind of a, they use the socioeconomic status of those people as the quote-unquote conflict, when, like, in reality, they're soulmates, compatible, whatever you want to say. But it's, you know, it's obviously a kids movie, and we're not gonna absolutely tear it apart like we did Harry Potter. Well,
I think we think that Harry Potter owes us something.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
because oh my god, we again, if we were to pay Jim Dale in fucking like units of like minutes and stuff, it's like there's just this debt we cannot pay.
Oh, but yeah, insurmountable.
With Aladdin, again, I think that there's part of I guess, like, not to say that there's a lesson, but like, or part of it, again, just there's a little bit of like, here's what we can deduce from the story, is to say that like, don't let so, or do your best, I guess, do your best not to let socioeconomic circumstances influence or impact like the decisions you make about love and intimacy and whatever, right? And say that like, look at these two people, they were destined to be together.
Yep.
Right. And they could, and man, it was close, wasn't it? Because class and like their status could have got, and almost like again, a little bit of like a their assumptions about each other, right?
Yep.
To say like, and we talk, there's like this interplay between the two of them and a lot of the scenes where it's to say that like, you know, say like, like, I forget exactly, but like Aladdin's like, aren't you hungry? And she's like, oh, sure. Yep. I'm hungry.
Yeah. No, I've had seven meals today. I've had seven square meals today.
That's
and you,
exactly.
And you have half a loaf of bread.
Yeah. That, I mean,
that like, he was again, willing to split with her.
Yeah, absolutely. That he wanted to split with her. And then like he split with his pet monkey.
Abu. Of course.
But yeah.
Real talk though, Aladdin is fantastic. I think we were talking about it as a family on this last trip. It holds up to this day. There are, I mean, listen, Robin Williams is the genie. Iago,
the comedian,
is so good. Absolutely.
Rodney Dangerfield.
No. It's not Rodney Dangerfield. It's right. What's his face? Robin Williams. Robin Williams does the impression of Rodney Dangerfield. Like, oh, I can't believe it. He into the rug. Yeah,
right. I mean, okay, hold on a second.
I'm looking it up right now.
Gilbert Gottfried.
Exactly. Absolutely, Gilbert Gottfried. And yeah. Like that's hilarious. Great movie. But back to our dark roast theme is, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, don't let the socioeconomic constraints, you know, rule the way you live, or to the best of your ability, right? Sometimes you don't have a choice, but to the best of your ability. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it seems that you've got your fresh coffee beans. It is time to grind them up and roast them. Brother Brendan, what flavors and notes are you picking up from this week's dark roast?
Well, I think that my primary reaction, because of how all over the place we've been, is simply that money is complicated.
Okay? It is.
I think that's the primary flavor that's sticking out in tonight's roast. I think that there's probably a reactive scale here to say that money is important, and the more important something is, I think maybe probably the more complicated it is. Right. I think that at least again, this, so brothers, I know you're all shocked to hear this, but brothers Brendan and Andrew are American. And I think that part of the way that we see money, and the way that maybe a lot of, again, there's, I don't think we're alone, but I see a lot of people see money as very closely tied to their identity. And I think that stories can just like Brother Andrew, like we've been talking about, say like adjusting the knobs related. Excuse me.
Very nice.
Thank you. Should we?
I concur.
I'm going to leave that in because that's very like Rick.
Leave it in. No, we're not editing that out.
How closely it ties to your identity, I think, is important. And I think that an odd reflection here is to say that like how much of our character is driven by our identification with our socioeconomic class, or perceived socioeconomic class, or perceived whatever, say like in our stories.
Yeah, I agree.
It does impact our stories in like significantly. So I think it also should impact our fiction, right? It's important, I think, to be able to just like any other subject, like touch on different parts of our identity and why they're important to us. I think overused, it can be distracting or even detracting. I think that I'm so proud of us because we have not ripped Star Wars apart in this episode.
Listen, I was told pre-recording to pump the brakes, so I could have, but I didn't.
Okay, then I will be the one to say, just to leave nobody in the audience in any ambiguity, I also am very disappointed about the fact that somehow fuel economy, and I guess by some extension, economy in general, as used as a driving force in Star Wars, I guess specifically The Last Jedi, is really difficult to reconcile.
Yeah, it sucks.
Tough to like to add again. Like I do my best because I'm trying. I want to. Brother Andrew knows that I've been having this like existential crisis since Disney World started to try and like integrate what we're seeing with like my larger Star Wars, because I don't want it to like all fall. Like I'm really trying to keep it together here, and it just doesn't add up. Okay, the fuel economy as a part of The Last Jedi is part of that. So finally, I think money can also be both a encouragement and a warning in stories, is to say that like I do think that money is part of like, again, this Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, is to say like you, like if you have integrity and if you are industrious and if you, you know, if you do your best, right, then money will manifest, right? But I think it also can be a warning, is to say like if you're over indexed in how much money you make or don't make or whatever, it will rule your whole identity.
So my flavors and hints that I'm picking up from this week's Dark Roast is kind of goes along with what Brother Brennan just said. But I think if used correctly, I think currency and economy can be an effective tool in the narrative to create conflicts and resolutions. In some instances, it can fall short of that. But I think if you responsibly and properly maintain those dials that we've been talking about, turn it up when it needs to, turn it down when it needs to, then it can be a good, effective, tool within a story. And lastly, just kind of even to go off that, is just currency and economy should not be so overpowering in a story that it changes the game. And when I say changes the game, it goes back to the example that we've been using quite often of the, you know, if you're reading a story, you can equate that story to a football game. And the currency economy of that football game / story should not overpower the actual narrative, and should be a kind of a sub structure of that story. So I think it overall, you know, other than Harry Potter, which we demand answers with, but everything else does a great job.
Alrighty, audience, as you are probably aware, we've really picked apart our discussion this week on money. We want to ask, what are some of your favorite examples of money, and what do you think we missed as far as any big examples, like really good examples of where money plays a role, either really effectively or ineffectively in the stories and TV shows and movies and et cetera that we watch. And then finally, like, what's your take on it? What did we miss anything as far as like how, like broadly speaking, why is money important, and how we tell stories to each other?
Let us know on Discord. You can let us know on Discord, or you can shoot us an email, or you can shoot us a tweet. So let us know. And without further ado, we'll jump right into our Espresso Roast. As a brief refresher, Espresso Roast is a lightning round style segment where the Brothers Coffee take your questions and cram their answers into 30 seconds. Today we have one question that both of us are going to tackle. It is a... I'd say it's an age old question. It's similar to what came first, chicken or the egg. I will put 30 seconds on the clock, and I will post the query to Brother Brendan. The question is, are fish wet? Your time starts now.
So generally speaking, I would have to say yes, fish are wet. I think that the only way to answer this question is to say that is to ask the inverse of are they dry, which I think the answer has to be no. I guess the question becomes is, do they know they're wet, or does it matter to them? And I have to say that, like, I know some fish well, and the answer is no, they don't.
Time. What fish do you know? Who are they?
I mean, honestly, oh my God, actually I have to ask in real time on the air, did Paul make it?
Oh, Paul lived. Paul, somehow, some way, my betta fish survived 10 days. We got him this little like freeze dried food that's supposed to be like quote unquote vacation food for betta fish. And it like slowly dissolves or whatever. But like, we didn't really know if Paul was going to know what to do with that. So we came back and he was A-okay.
That's fine.
Which is stunning. I was shocked.
This episode brought to you both betta fish and from whatever slow release food mechanism.
Freeze dried food. Yep.
That's incredible.
It works.
So I guess Paul is really the only fish that I guess sort of know by extension, but I feel like speaking on behalf of Paul, think that he is wet, and I guess knows it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And I will personally ask Paul after we sign off, just so. And I'll relay the information back to you on next week's podcast, but I'll ask him just so we know.
All right. Then in that case, in anticipation of the answer from Paul, Brother Andrew, are fish wet? 30 seconds on the clock. Go.
I'm going to go with no, because while fish do reside in water, I would associate the word wet as being out of water, but still having water on you. If that makes sense.
Shit.
Because if your shoes are wet, your shoes aren't underwater. They're just wet. So
time. Yeah, and
so,
and
stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
Wow. And I also used up like a second of yours by to say like, oh shit, because it's so, I mean, I guess, wow.
We report, you decide. So, like we said earlier, let us know on Discord. You know, you got both sides of the coin right there. Let us know on Discord what you think.
Listen, you seem like you've got the jitters. Probably enough caffeine for one day. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed this podcast, share it with your friends. Give us a rating review on iTunes and hit that subscribe button.
So, this is Brother Andrew.
And Brother Brendan.
Have a good one.